session number 18523, reel 3.
Ted Winkler, reel 3. You were just telling me about what your job involved on beach defence in the Pas de Calais in 1944.
In Strong Point Alf at Bray Dunes, it was. And last time I talked to you, I was mentioning the tripwires and rolled, opened out drums with a incendiary device fitted to it to give a warning if anybody would approach us from the beach.
Did you believe that the British would invade?
Well, we didn't, but we would have possibly expected small groups of people for sabotage or something like it. We didn't expect an invasion on that point, because actually those strong points were never taken. They were evacuated after the war.
Did you feel confident in the strength of the defences?
They were substantial. The bunkers were very thick-walled, and we had a periscope. We didn't need to go out of them to see what was happening outside. And there was interconnecting channels to the gun emplacements, and etc. We used to have to keep them covered with the sand of the dunes. Used to be sort of opened out to the elements. When they had a wind blowing, it used to move the sand away from the bunkers. So we covered them up again.
What was the quality of the soldiers who were guarding the beaches?
They were not especially good soldiers. They were usually slightly misfits or something like it. I would say in the capacity as an armourer.
By misfits, do you mean people who
well,
have been
well, they had been in Russia. Some of them had no, for instance, we had a couple of people that had had shell shock and things like that. They were not really fit to be on the Eastern Front, so they were good enough to be on the Western Front.
Was this a happy or unhappy time for you in Bray Dunes?
Well, it was reasonably happy because nothing much was happening. I had an encounter with a Spitfire at one time. I was on my way from Bray Dunes to there was a big hospital along nearer towards Dunkirk, and I had a machine gun and a couple of rifles over my shoulder walking along the beach. And the Spitfire came along and took pot shots at me.
What were living conditions like for you by now?
Oh, they were reasonable there. The food, etc., was quite good. Besides, we were always able to supplement something by buying something of the French population, farms, etc.
What's happened to you next?
Oh, now then, this is a problem. I'm trying to remember. Dunkirk.
Were you still there when D-Day occurred?
No, I was in the south of France. I was at, that was it. We went to Souge near Bordeaux in a big camp there. It was a training camp. And we had a colossal number of people there and a small brothel outside, which were queuing. There was actually a queue being formed.
Who was in the brothel?
Our French girls, yeah.
Professional prostitutes?
Oh, yes, it must have been. And in my capacity as an armourer, I had to go to Bordeaux myself, and one of those girls were on the bus. I had a talk with her, and I said to her, well, you're a nice-looking girl, and why do you do this? And she says, I'm in here, I'm making a lot of money, and when I've got enough money, I marry my boyfriend to buy a farm. That was the idea. Anyhow, just one of the sidelines.
So were you being trained in this camp?
That was a training camp, yeah.
What were you being trained in?
Well, the usual, what we call square bushing, or you call square bushing. It seemed to be rather futile to me. From there, I went to, as an advance party, an officer and I went to Sallisdell Barn, right up in the mountains. And we stayed there in the Hotel Anglais, a British hotel, which had a rickety electric lift in there.
Which mountains?
At the Spanish side, towards Spain. There was Pau d'Ax, that area. You know, we were right up there, and we stayed there for about 2 months, and nothing much happened there. I think they changed their mind, and we were recalled from there. And then from there we went to Istres. Now then, near Arles, you know, Arles down there.
This is in the Rhone corridor.
Yeah, there was a torpedo bomber, Junkers 88, and we were there as perimeter defense.
To defend the airplanes?
Well, to make sure that nobody got onto the airplanes. There were Junkers 88 with torpedoes fitted for the Mediterranean area.
Had D-Day occurred by now?
Well, it had by then, and I got this telegram to return to Germany to the Air Ministry from, you know, the Rüstungsluft, as they call it, the rearmament air. You know, and went first of all to Leipzig to the headquarters, and they sent me to Dresden and to Erler Aircraftwerk in Leipzig. I was working at various shops, and that's where I worked on the Messerschmitt 262 at Erler and Dresden. First as an inspector, and then they found out I was an armourer. I installed the MK-108 cannons.
What were the main problems in doing that job?
It wasn't so much of a problem as those aircrafts were out of not an aircraft factory, they were in a disused airfield, and they were there because I'd been bomb damaged, and I made out reports for the various defects that had to be repaired, etc. And, which panel would have to be replaced, and that's like. Did that for about 2 months there. And then they transferred me back to the firm of Flugzeugwerke Graudenz in the Polish corridor. And that's where I looked after the Messerschmitt 109E and F and G and installed the guns in those, which I used to work the whole week through. I never left the premises. And when a machine was ready, I had my own sort of area where, at a channel where I used to get the aircraft down there, roll it down. I had a license to roll the aircraft. I couldn't fly it, but I could roll it. Used to take it down to there, anchor it down, put it in a horizontal position, start the engine, or first of all, install the guns and sight them by periscope type. You know, to a target which was about 500 meters further down in a sort of channel we had there. And then use the gun to fire actual round after we had made the timing right that the prop would be out of the way, sort of. And they had two Russian helpers there, Heavies, they used to call them, Hilfsvillige, who used to do the menial works for me.
By this time, did you feel that the war still could be won for Germany?
Yes, I was still fairly confident at that time. It was, I was called back from there to the army and went to Bergen by Celle. It was a sort of regrouping camp. And we were all sort of called out and we were divided up to where we were going to be sent. And I was on the group that was going to be sent to Russia. And the officer there said, I want an armorer, you know, and I was fortunate enough to be transferred to the western side and went to Holland.
You must have been relieved, right?
I was relieved, yes. I didn't fancy Russia at all. Nobody did. We had too many stories from there, of people over there.
What kind of stories were you hearing?
Well, a friend of mine, he was together at school with me. I met him in on a leave. He taught me that it was very brutal down there, that the Russians had no compunction about attacking, even if they hadn't got a chance, heavy machine guns. And he said in the winter they used to mow him down, and then when the corpses had frozen, they used to go forward, use them as a sort of defense barrier, and it brutalized people there.
So where did you go to instead?
I went to, first of all, I went to where was it? Arnhem. Yeah. Arnhem, that was after the after your paratrooper, after that area, went there. And we were stationed in Wageningen, that's the place, Wageningen.
They in it, Holland?
In Holland, which actually had a sort of shipping research station, a long channel where they used to get wax models and sort of put them down there to get the various resistances and those like. And that's where we had a sort of encounter with a V1. And one day we were out on an exercise and a low-flying V1 hit a tree and came towards us. So we run away like nuts towards it to foreshorten the run sort of the thing. And it hit another tree. And then it belly landed and didn't actually explode. And it was quite a, whenever you were on duty, I had to stand guard with all the, we were the staff company, if you know what I mean, staff's company. We had to take turns in standing on guard. And when you stood on guard at night and you heard one of those V1s coming and the sound cut out, you were flat on your face before the thing came down, you know.
So they were out of control. This one was out of control.
Yes, the first one was out of control, and some of them just, you know, started earlier. You were never sure what time they would come down or what. They were sort of controlled by the amount of fuel or whatever it was. And if there was a fault in the fuel system, we had a later in when we were in Arnhem. We had the same thing there. One of the V1s actually, we were billeted in a block of flats, if you know what a block of flats, and the V1 hit into the center of it, and we lost 14 men. And I remember when I was in my bed there sleeping, and a very bright light in the wall on the side where I was had disappeared. You know, so that was my encounter with the second encounter with a V1.
And you were serving with the Wehrmacht, were you?
This was the Air Force Field Division.
Air Force Field Division.
Mm-hmm. Air Force Field Division, which became later on paratroopers. And again, I think it was more than anything a sort of camouflage, because the only training we did was from wooden towers.
You were jumping yourself?
Just from a wooden tower. You used to climb up the tower. They used to weigh you. You had a counterweight on the cable. You had an arm you swung out. And then the counterweight let you drop at a certain rate.
So you were actually training to be a paratrooper?
Oh, yes.
And this is late 1944?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mind you, again, I think that was more than anything to say we were paratroopers, because we were on the field division.
And this was in the Arnhem area?
No, this training was in the... what they call the place now. I'm not sure what they call the place. I can't remember. Quite a time ago.
But Germany?
It was in Germany. It was a camp where we couldn't get out. You know, there was no... They had actually guards around the camp. We were kept in the camp in rather very tight conditions, very early calls and exercises and all that kind of stuff all day long. We were toughened up for whatever was in front of us.
So what happened next?
Well, from Arnhem, we went into Germany. We crossed the border at Sevenaar, they called the place, and we went to Emmerich on the Rhine. That is on the eastern side of the Rhine. And your troops were already on the opposite side of the Rhine. They used to shell over to us and just like. And it was a rather quiet time because we had sort of reed camouflage and we could still go under the Rhine and base and things like that. And we were stationed there in... I was in the hotel in Emmerich. The rest were in brickworks, and they were having their quarters inside the kilns, which was quite a bomb-proof area.
Was this in the winter?
Yes, it was towards winter, yeah. And from Emmerich, they sent us to Ries to cross the Rhine there. There was no bridge there, and we had some ferries to go across. And the area was under heavy fire by the Americans, as far as we could make out. And that's where I encountered one rather memorable thing to me. Was I was down in an air raid shelter, but the air raid shelter down was locked, and we all sort of piled into this air raid shelter, and there was a chappie behind me, and I told the chappie behind me, get off, you know, sort of, and he actually was dead. A splinter had hit him. That was rather not very nice experience.
You were under shell fire, you mean?
Yes, under shell fire, heavy shell fire. And they were knowing that we must have had observation or something, that we were trying to cross a river on ferries. We lost two ferries to artillery fire.
Were you going on a raid or something? No,
we were sent across what we called Sumpfheizen. We were there only to stem the advance.
And Ries is on the Rhine?
Ries is on the eastern side of the Rhine. And we went over, what they call the place now. We left all our kit and everything like that in a farm, it was a public house there in the yard, all our rucksacks and bits and pieces. And they took the machine pistols off us before we crossed the Rhine, and they gave us French 1870-71 rifles with pig stickers on the end, about a yard long. And we were actually just there to stem that once. And I was still armourer then. I didn't go into it too much. And I was at Kevenheim, they call the village there. And in Kevenheim, there was a nunnery. And the area was under shell fire. And I went there and said, well, you've got wine cellars. Why don't you go into the wine cellars? And they just didn't want to go. They were praying in their chapel, and I found afterwards that I had a direct hit.
They had
a direct hit, and they lost quite a few. The people themselves, I was in the parson's house there. They were in the cellar, and they were praying, some of it in Latin, and I didn't understand. And I said, what are they praying for, to a friend of mine? They said, well, they haven't got any water, they want water. I said, why don't they ask us? He said, they wouldn't ask you, you're a Protestant. So I went across to the farm shed, sort of, and got under the pump with a couple of buckets and pumped the water on the way back. Again, a couple of grenades hit it. I was with two buckets down under the road, and took it down into the cellar and knocked on the door where they were, and here's some water for you. They didn't thank me.
And this again was the Americans who were shelling?
I'm not sure who was shelling me at Kevenheim. It was possibly the British on that side. And at that time it was getting pretty rough, because even if to get back when we went over Sevenaar, we had no transport whatsoever. We had the German paratroopers with wheelbarrows, with bicycles without tires, whatever we could find to transport our stuff, and they were stretched out over miles. I was fortunate enough, I had a Dutch laundry one which I converted into an armory, and I was running it at alcohol, because in Wageningen there had been an agricultural research station, and the grain samples they had there, they were stored in alcohol, so I siphoned off all the alcohol and run it on there. But that one was left on the western, on the eastern side. We hadn't got that with us then. But it was really, we knew it was finished. And from there, I went to, on the 2nd of March 45, we went to Winnekendonk, where I was that day taken prisoner. And the layout we had, there was one of us sort of every 15 to 20 meters, a German paratrooper. We had raided the local houses and got feather bedding, and put soil over it, because they were good anti-bullet, because you can shoot through a feather bed. That was one of the things. But when we saw your lot coming on the other side, it was out of this world for us. There was a tank, a mass group of infantry between another tank, there was, for each one of us, there was about 20 people there. And they were staggered three deep. It was three columns, tank, infantry, stuck it behind tank infantry and stuck it behind three deep. So we knew it was hopeless even then. You know, the had before that, they had run away many a time just to get to the next road sort of by that once. So I didn't go down into the cellar. There was a sort of, storage cellar for crops and things, possibly potatoes and things. They all went into the cellar, but I stopped up and I raised my hands and had my surrender paper in my hand. And the first English words I heard was, "Shall I kill the fat bastard?"
Did you understand it?
No, I didn't. I didn't know what it was, what it meant. That was a word that wasn't in my dictionary. And from there on...
But did you know they were threatening to kill you?
Oh, yes, I killed, but, you know, it didn't happen. Then they sent me across and on my own, sort of. I hear later on that they actually threw grenades into that cellar. No, I don't know how many of that lot survived from there.
Who were these troops who captured you?
They were Highland Division, as far as I can make out. That red and white squares. The officers had red and white squares on their Glengarries, they call them, don't they? And they were that. And as I was sort of going west, I was on my own. A medical orderly came up to me and asked me what time it was, and he promptly took my watch. And then I got to a place, and there it was just a building, and there was an officer on a table there, and he was asking me questions of the various units, which was like, and while we were there, we had the German Nebelwerfer, the rocket-propelled projectiles, hitting that area, and every time one come close by, the officer used to disappear underneath the table while I was standing. I was used to it, and it was quite amusing. And from there, they sent us to, well, I've got the thing set to Tilburg in Holland. We were in a cellar there. There was found later it was a weaving place, you know, they used to weave cloth there, and we were in the cellar and we were caged there, and we had rather a rough time because they tried to interrogate us with rather brutal methods. They put them against the wall and used to, I don't know whether it was blanks, but they fired at them with machine pistols, sort of, you know, to make them tell what units or whatever it was in.
Did they get any information?
I suppose they did in the end. And from there they sent us to Brussels. But to get back to that day at Winnekendonk, there was one rather surprising thing, and I don't know whether it's well known. When those tanks fired at us, the British tanks, the British people didn't, the soldiers didn't take cover for possible splinters. And they used a sort of a dummy shell, which was cardboard, I would presume. It used to make the sound of a bullet coming, and when they exploded, it used to just make a noise, and possibly, you know, but there wasn't any splinters. That was rather...